listening to North Atlantic Radio with your hosts, Brian Zuta and Matt Rickard.
Okay, welcome to episode 8 of North Atlantic Radio. We're mucking about with things a bit here, tinkering with the format, and we're actually, this is recording this intro after we've recorded the whole podcast. So, Brian, how did you think the podcast went?
A bit rocky. The Skype wasn't the greatest, but I think it was one of the better ones we've knocked out.
That's good. Keep people interested. I think it's the best one we've ever done. We did have some technical problems. Skype kept dropping on us and a few interruptions here and there. So hopefully it doesn't sound a bit too, you know, starty, finishy. But it went well, I think. We've been on the phone for about an hour now, I think, haven't we, as well?
Yeah. That's so pretty pathetic about for a 15-minute podcast.
Yeah, imagine how much we have to cut. How much crap
like
we talk.
All of this.
Yeah. Anyway, we enjoyed doing this podcast, so hope you enjoyed too. And see you in 15 minutes' time.
Okay, for the second podcast in a row now, we're going to try a little bit of heroes and villains. The idea behind this is in the last 3 weeks, we kind of highlight someone or some company who's done something incredible, and then someone or some company who's in the doghouse, and kind of just quickly explain what's going on. So Matt, who's your hero and villain this week?
I'm going to follow the example set by the Nobel Peace Prize board and give my Heroes Award not to, I'm going to give it to Flickr, not for something necessarily they've done, but for the potential of the idea they've come up with. So a few weeks ago, they wrote a blog post mentioning that they now have this support for OpenStreetMap machine tags, and that allows you to tag a photo similar to geocoding, where you mark it, where it's essentially the same as marking it specifically on a map, but you don't just mark it explicitly on the specifically on the map. You say what object you have the photo taken of, so you put in a machine tag that says this is a photo of this object in the OpenStreetMaps database. And then Flickr can go and get that information from OpenStreetMap, and they can say this is a picture of where the Houses of Parliament, or this is a picture of this street, or this lake, or this road, or anything that's an object in the OpenStreetMaps database. You can say that you've taken a photo of it. So fantastic metadata opportunities. The actual implementation of it is really, it's not easy to use. I can't see, you know, people doing this as easily they have geocoding it, because it involves, well, in fact, I'm not even sure how you're supposed to find the ID of the objects that you have in your photos. But the potential of this to be able to tag your photos with specific objects that are in the photo, specific physical objects, is just fantastic. And my villain is the Royal Mail for being a bunch of assholes. In the 1960s, when the Royal Mail was still a government department, part of the post office, the government department invented the idea of postcodes. Everyone, or every house, or every set of houses got given a postcode, and that's, you know, the best method of sending mail now is, you know, for it to be organised. Everyone knows what a postcode is. Don't know why I'm explaining it. Anyway, they were created in the UK using public money, and now the Royal Mails are privatised, although I think wholly owned by the government, a privatised company. They're generally being dicks about allowing people to use postcode data. They claim that it makes them a lot of money. I think they say about 18 million a year, and so they're going around and making, even going to non-profit organisations and just telling them that if they're using any system that offers postcode geolocation service, that they can't do it. They get cease and desist letters, and, you know, they just continue to go around this, refusing to believe that there's any way that this could be beneficial to the Royal Mail, and, you know, refusing to accept that because this was made by public money, that public should be able to use this without paying for it. So they're generally just being typical evil people about this.
My hero this week is Mozilla for blocking of the Microsoft unstable plugins. Since then, they've reinstated it. But I really like, I think they're kind of the first people who have taken a stance and said, okay, Microsoft, your software is buggy. Your plugins are bringing down our browser. we gave you until Tuesday to patch it. Okay, you didn't. So we're just going to use our block list and straight up block your plugins. And I think it was the .NET common runtime library. It was fairly big ones. I think they've since backed down because too many corporate customers needed it. And I guess they still figured an unsafe Mozilla is still safer than a unpatched IE. So
explain what it was. I can see it was Microsoft's .NET Framework Assistant add-on for Firefox, and that was something that Microsoft put into Firefox without users' knowledge. It just got added into Firefox, and then Microsoft, I believe so.
Yeah, Microsoft got, which is part of one of the downloads.
And Microsoft got Mozilla got annoyed with that because it was a crappy add-on, or if not crappy, it was at least buggy, and Microsoft weren't fixing it. So Mozilla were getting complaints, presumably, for the browser crashing when it had nothing to do with Mozilla. So they just thought, right, screw this.
We're going to use our power to outright block
and
it.
And they did. Your hero for taking that power, not for...
Well. Correct. for taking the stance and saying, we're going to stand up to the big guy, and if the big guy isn't going to fix it, we're going to try and protect our customers. So they're my hero for the week. And then my villain for the week is Twitter. I mean, I do love Twitter, but they came out with this whole concept of lists. And while it might be nice, it's a bit of a pathetic attempt to control the sprawl. I mean, Facebook did it with groups. And basically, once your social network gets too big for you to actually handle, you've got to splice it off some way. And lists seems to be the bit of a cop-out. I mean, the better option would be not have so many friends. I mean, why have 3,000 followers, or why follow 3,000 people? The signal-to-noise ratio is got to be so high. And then putting them into groups, culls some of that signal-to-noise, but then do you ever look at the noise anyway? So, if we can get over the fact that we add people just because we feel a social need to, and then the way we solve it is groups and lists. I'd certainly hope that they could come up with something a little better. So, it doesn't really address the problem.
About a week or so ago, I wrote a blog post that I've had in draft for probably about 9 months now, all about how we need to kind of bring in the idea of legal deposit to the web. Legal deposit being the system that national libraries have in place to make sure that every book published in a country is kept, as at least one copy kept. So that the idea being that you've got a historical archive of everything that was published, so that academics can go back and see things. Basically see everything that was going on at the time, because the written word is so important to human culture and national cultures across the world, that without that archive, then we'd lose a huge amount of knowledge, as well as losing a huge amount of information about humanity as it's gone on, for the last 600 years. And we're kind of in the period now where national libraries are just about catching on to the idea that that we really should be doing with this with the web. I think the French National Library is now legally obliged to keep everything on .fr domains. And obviously people will know archive.org, the Internet Archive, for doing something very similar, but not on a legal basis for about the last, I think, 12, 13 years or something like that. And my argument was pretty much that we just need to make sure that this happens, that we don't lose... we don't lose the huge amounts of information that, certainly in Western culture, that we're putting onto the internet now. And books are obviously still being published, but so much more, especially on a personal level, is being published on the web. That if we lose personal blogs, newspapers, multi-author blogs and so on, we could be losing the modern equivalent of Samuel Pepys or Anne Frank and so on and so on.
I think the example you used before is the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
Do you want to give a quick rundown on
I'd love to, Brian. Thank you.
the document that everybody knows is the one that you see in textbooks, but there's a whole other side to it that very few people know about.
I started off by saying how the one of Thomas Jefferson's original drafts, he was Jefferson being the main author behind the Declaration of Independence, the US Declaration of Independence, as I should say. In one of his earlier drafts, he was really, really strongly against slavery and made a point to say that slavery is this hideous act, and I don't believe, or we as colonies don't believe, that this should take place. And this gets removed from the final draft, and I can imagine, you know, some of the southern, what became states like Georgia and South Carolina, reading it and going, "Whoa, Tom, sorry, can we just borrow you for a second? Can we just get rid of this, please?" And the fact that we've got those drafts means that we know that Jefferson wanted this in the first place and got overruled.
Right, but I think in this day and age, with, you know, the kind of blog post that's been, you know, polished and then published, we lose a lot of that draft. Wikipedia, luckily, has all the version history, so we can go back there. But on personal blogs, we kind of lose this.
Yeah, because once everyone publishes one thing and you get the finished article, but you've lost everything between them having a blank sheet of paper and them having the finished article. You don't know what happened, how that came about. Did they? I mean, in this very blog post that we're talking about now that I wrote, I kept versions of it. I kept them on GitHub and committed every time I made a major change. I committed to the GitHub repository. I can see my argument changing. I mean, the actual original article I wrote, I think it was in February, the first draft I wrote, is quite different to the final one. And I think this happens quite often in writing as well. You start off with an argument. By the time you get to the end of it, you actually either persuaded yourself differently, or you've changed it subtly. And, you know, it's interesting to see that. And obviously, on these points, you can see a personal interest, but on a larger scale, this will be of interest to many more people. Not my particular blog post, but
just the generally kind of the things, thought process, yeah, and how ebbs and flows and right, pros and cons might move with the politics or the culture of the day. Well, I think also the interesting thing is, you know, 200-300 years ago, it was very obvious who could publish a book. I mean, the monarchy had a monopoly on publishing in the UK, but it was just prohibitively expensive because you needed the equipment and the printing presses. So it made it very easy for libraries to say, you know, every time you print a book, we by law have to have one copy. When now printing or publishing has become so easy, even printing, it's more difficult to say, you know, what is a printing company? What is a printing house? You know, do I, making something on Lulu or Cafe Press, do I have to give one copy to the library? Now it's kind of based on ISBN numbers. But somewhere along the line, like you alluded to with the archive.org and the French system, they are going in reverse. They are looking for content and trying to save it, whereas we should offer, or they should offer, a system to where we can publish our blog or our, you know, information online, but then push it to them, just like publishing houses used to physically send these places a book.
Yeah, the problems behind legal deposit of books, magazines, and newspapers are well understood, because national libraries have been dealing with this for 400, 500 years. Because the web's so new, they've got we as a culture aren't necessarily understanding the problem. So yeah, we've flipped it at the moment. We have the equivalent of national libraries going into every bookshop they can find and searching the shelves for the books they're missing, and then taking a copy of that book. And if you saw national libraries doing that, walking into Waterstones on the high street and just making sure they've got every book, you'd be like, what the hell are you doing? But at the moment, that's precisely what's happening on the web, is the national libraries are taking it upon themselves to go around searching the web. And that's not necessarily the way it needs to. I think it would be very useful for it to flip, so that we go back to the way it is with published books, is that the libraries get notified when there's something new published, and then they take a copy of that.
Okay, and to wrap up the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been reading in the last 3 weeks. And basically, I haven't done much of anything. I've read a little bit more on... This is the first time I think Matt's going to outpace me on books. I've been reading a few more little sections in the Pillow book here and there, and I started one just the other day called Blue Ocean Strategy. It's an old book, and from the outside, it's very much all about like how to move your company into an area with no competitors, and it seems really kind of cheesy and like over a million copies sold. And I'm kind of thinking, if it's such a great book, I mean, there's probably some really good pearls of wisdom in there, but the concept of that, if there's been a million sold and it hasn't changed the way businesses do business, either the wrong people are reading it, or, I mean, it always could be that, you know, the people read it and then, you know, their boss isn't, you know, going to let them change it. But I think there's a lot of hype, and maybe it just needs to get into the right hands. So I'm about one or two chapters in. I'll give it a chance. I'm not really into the whole marketing buzz, but I don't think this book is really about that. And that's been about it. Lots of other random things, but not in the least bit worth mentioning.
Okay.
What about you?
I officially on my reading list is still the book that's been in probably just about every podcast we've recorded, Imprimatur, which I'm going to give up on the recommendation of my mum, of my own sanity. I've just, it's almost made me get sick of reading because I'm trying to struggle along with this book and not getting anywhere. So, because I don't want to start any other books, I was just getting, you know, no reading done. So I've picked up another two books, and I'm just, you know, racing through those. So I'm just going to give up on that book. So I'm not going to be able to tell you how it ends, I'm afraid. Sorry, guys. One of the books I picked up is The Time Traveler's Guide to Medieval England, which is fantastic. So far, really well researched as well. A guy is writing a book as if we invented time travel and we go back to about 1370, 1380 in England. And he's just describing it as if it's a like a travel guide. So he tells you about the landscape, about the cities, the towns you'll find, what the people there you'll find, what people you'll find there, how they'll smell, how they'll dress, what the countryside looks like. And he goes into all kinds of things like the customs and things like that and differences between regions and so on. And so far, it's really good. I would really recommend it. Much more fun than the last book, which I'll never mention again. And one of the other things I just picked up today is a quarterly journal, but it's expensive enough and thick enough to count in this section, I reckon. The Index on Censorship, which is a collection of essays, pretty much, about freedom of speech and so on. And I'm just going to get stuck into that. And that was episode 8 of North Atlantic Radio, all done, distilled for your listening enjoyment. Okay, well, as usual, you can find us at northatlanticradio.com. The show notes will be there, and any links to any of the websites or systems we've talked about and so on, we'll leave all the links there. We also always appreciate your feedback. hello@northatlanticradio.com. If you've got anything to say about the podcast, just let us know there, and we'll read it and get back to you. And hope you enjoy it. See you next time.